was a meltdown that happened somewhere. Poison the earth, water and air. But it isn't news with the TV or press, 'cause that was the week of Lady Gaga's new dress. Antiquities being destroyed in Iraq, children are starving from U.S. attack. But we never gave it one minute thought, 'cause that was the week John Edwards got caught. Telecom industry caught up in spying.
From Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and today Bowling Green, Ohio, welcome to the Tim Danahy Show here at Danahy.com, and we're a proud member of the Coffee Party USA Network. And today we're going to be talking about another Trojan horse working its way through the U.S. Capitol, and it's called the National Defense Authorization Act, the NDAA. And ostensibly, it's supposed to provide, the budget authorization to let the Defense Department and military to do whatever they do with $600 billion a year. But there's some frightening little clauses in there that are designed to usurp your constitutionally protected freedoms. And we're going to talk more on that in a few minutes. But first, let's talk about a few items in the news. And first of all, Rupert Murdoch, the guy who owns Fox News, 21st Century Fox, and a bunch of other media stuff, including the Wall Street Journal. Well, Rupert Murdoch is 84 years old. Many of you have seen him, and he has been looking far and wide for a successor. And this week it was announced that after an exhaustive search for the most qualified people, the experts to run the Fox empire, the search has uncovered the best candidate. And Rupert Murdoch has named his son, James Murdoch, as the new CEO of Fox News and all the other entities involved. However, that still leaves the issue of who will be the executive chairman of the board. And so another exhaustive search has discovered the most qualified person to be Fox News' new executive chairman of the board, and he's Rupert Murdoch's other son, Lachlan Murdoch. So Fox News will carry forth to declining TV ratings. They have an aging viewership and rapidly growing ridicule as a news organization. They'll be moving forward firmly and confidently in the hands of more Murdochs, and while the Eloi try to live in peace. And now, that last sentence was an obscure reference to something that, if you know what I'm talking about, you'll get bonus points. And speaking of the Wall Street Journal, they've written an article entitled, "How Many TV Shows Can Your Brain Handle?" Well, there's good news with this, and apparently there's no limit on how much TV you can watch or keep track of characters or follow storylines and enjoy. The article has some really interesting statistics about our TV habits. And some of the statistics in this article were really fascinating to me because some were surprising. It reports that there were 371 original scripted series on television last year. And that includes services such as Amazon and Netflix and Hulu. And I guess that would include that one with Kevin Spacey, whatever that's called, about Washington, D.C., and Orange is the New Black, and those special ones. But 371 scripted shows on television last year. I was surprised by that. Now, here's a number that may amaze you, maybe not. The article went on to cite a Nielsen survey, and it said adults in the United States spend about 39 hours a week watching TV or catching up with shows on their own time by way of like DVRs or Netflix or any other streaming technology. 39 hours a week, so that would be we're talking about 5 hours a day. You get home from work, so about 6 to 11 every day. 7 days a week, Americans are watching television, adults. Another thing that I thought was interesting is about the way that we're watching television. And Netflix members who completed at least one full season of a TV series in the past year. About 60% of them stuck with one show at a time, taking an average of 2 weeks to finish a season. So that means binge watching is really taking hold. So people, 60% of people are watching a year of a television show in less than 2 weeks. Fascinating statistic. Another statistic that came through is how many shows do you think the average American watches regularly? And you think about it. Okay, let's suppose you watch Big Bang Theory, or you watch Dancing with the Stars or something like that. How many shows do you think the average American watches regularly? Well, the answer to that one, according to TrackTTV, it's an app that tracks your TV viewing. Most Americans watch about five shows regularly, and that's an interesting number. And then what's another thing that TrackTTV has discovered is that the average American watches about 18 shows that add up to, and this will be amazing, 92 episodes per month. Just a startling number. So I guess the best thing we can do is, so if you're listening to this show and if you're involved with different issues, if you're working hard to protect your rights from a secretive government, if you're out doing something social and active, anything, if you're out doing it, if you're out doing anything except watching TV, honestly, I salute you. You know, and that kind of reminds me of a story that was told to me back in a long time. I was at Cleveland State University at the time, and I remembered it then. And a current author, Malcolm Gladwell, confirmed it with some numbers that he published as recently as just a few years ago. But I had this professor named Professor Begadov at Cleveland State University, and he was a professor of production management, of all things. And he was just a tremendously driven man. He was passionate about what he does, and he wanted people to succeed. He wanted people to get out. He wanted people to get out and do things. And the class at Cleveland State, a bunch of undergraduates like me, was not particularly responsive to him. He was not connecting with the class, and so he had this outburst at the class. And I swear I was the only one who listens, and I would guarantee that I'm the only one who remembers. But he kind of yelled at the classroom. He says, and I think he was from Israel, but he goes, "You Americans, you spend 40 hours a week watching television." And he says, "Why do you do that?" He goes, "It's passive participation." And Professor Begadov brought up the point. He says, you know, you watch 40 hours of television. He says, "Can you act? Can you write a script? You know, can you direct a story, design a scene? Can you do anything?" And he goes, "No, you can't, because it's passive participation." And then Professor Begadov goes on, you know, and he says, "If you spent 40 hours a week doing anything, in anything active, you know, you could play an instrument, you could do research, you could write, you could perfect your skills in a sport or golf or whatever, spent time concentrating, anything active. And if you spent 40 hours a week at it, within just a couple years, you'd be one of the best in the world at what you do. And that's just a reward for being active and not just watching TV." So, Professor Begadov, I tend to doubt if you're even still around anymore, but at least one of your stories carries forth, and I certainly appreciate it. Also, in the news, we've got some good employment news. After construction workers got hammered ever since 2008, and you remember the crash, I mean, the banks fell, everything happened, and nobody got hit as hard as construction people did. There was no money. There was banks weren't lending. Municipal, state, local governments didn't have the money. Nationally, the Congress did not want to put money into infrastructure for infrastructure spending for political reason. I mean, it was miserable for the construction industry. No one was building. No jobs. No living wages for anybody. You know the story. But the construction tide is turning, and the Wall Street Journal reported under a headline on page A3 of some a recent day. It said, "Skills Gap Hammers Builders," and it was written by a gentleman by the name of Jeffrey Sparshot. But it opens by saying U.S. builders shed more than 2 million jobs during and after the housing bust, and now they say they can't find enough carpenters, electricians, plumbers, and other craftsmen for a growing pipeline of work. And the one result of their predicament, it says, they're among the industries seeing signs of wage pressures forcing firms in the industry to boost compensation, step up recruitment, and turn toward labor-saving technologies. And the article goes on to report on the situation. And it's a gentleman by the name of Mark Lugering, a senior vice president of Messer Construction, said, "Certainly there is a race to find quality craft workers out on the marketplace." And so it's interesting to see how this turns, but there's a problem here. And because industry-wide, commercial construction payrolls are still about 15% less than their peak level. And while that should mean that there's a lot of workers available, there's 15% fewer people available, and they should be able to get those jobs. The companies can't find them. And so a guy named Tim McNew, who's a senior vice president at TD Industries, a Dallas-based builder, he said, "Finding experienced people is difficult. When the economy shrank and the construction industry shrank, there are a lot of people who left and they haven't returned." And so what the story goes on and says, "Many departed the business for opportunities in the oil and gas industry or elsewhere, while others in an aging workforce simply retired. And to find new recruits, there has been a push to have schools lay a better educational foundation for the industry, but that effort is still developing." And that kind of gets back to the issue with community colleges and vocational schools and other non-traditional. They're valid and traditional methods of providing a workforce for America, but for some reason they have been discredited or dishonored for their role. People look down on community colleges and vocational schools, but they teach trades. They teach the electricians. They train the carpenters. They provide the construction management skills and skills that America needs badly. So now, while we're trying to build, and we have somewhere between $2 to $3 trillion of civil engineering and civil projects like roads, highways, and dams that need to be done, because we've turned our noses up to people who are in the trades, and because we have not invested in teaching the trades and respecting the trades and respecting the unions who organize the trades, as a result, America wants to build, but we can't, because we've neglected the people who build America. So when we come back, we're going to be talking with Dan Johnson, and he's with People Against the NDAA, and your constitutional rights are at risk, and you're going to want to hear this here on the Tim Danny Show. We'll be right back.
State Department war is inciting, but that was the week survivors were fighting. Bradley Manning is sitting in jail.
Teddy Roosevelt said, "Of all forms of tyranny, the least attractive and the most vulgar is the tyranny of mere wealth." This is why antitrust law and competition is essential to America's economic health. This is why the Organization for Competitive Markets works to reclaim competition for farmers, ranchers, and rural communities across America. We believe our duty is to advocate a just role for government in the agricultural economy, an enforcer of rules necessary for markets that are fair, honest, and accessible. The Organization for Competitive Markets. Learn more at competitivemarkets.com.
Patriot Act is reading your mail. Aaron Schwartz is suicidal, but everyone's watching American Idol.
We, the people of the United States of America, reject the U.S. Supreme Court Citizens United ruling and other related cases, and move to amend our Constitution to firmly establish that money is not speech, and that human beings, not corporations, are persons entitled to constitutional rights. Go to movetoamend.org. Add your voice to the 350,000 people who say, enough. This is a government of the people, by the people, for the people.
There was the week more families died. Drones in the skies commit genocide. Oh, that was the week they could have been saved. But there wasn't room for them on the front page. Oh, that was the week.
Welcome back to the Tim Danney Show here at DanneyHe.com. And imagine a country where military and government conspire to authorize bills for which the people have little or no input, and there's little or no public debate. And you would guess that the United States and the TPP, you're thinking, and you'd be right. But believe it or not, it's also happening with something called the NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act. And it contains, for one thing, the Pentagon's $600 billion budget that we have to pay. And it was drafted and voted upon in the Senate Armed Services Committee almost entirely in secret. In fact, less than 25% of our own U.S. senators that even had the chance to offer amendments, and those are only done behind closed doors. This bill, this NDAA, is more than 1,000 pages, and it's voted upon without much public debate. But this is more than a secret Pentagon budget. It has other aspects which might additionally explain all the secrecy. And so here to discuss the NDAA is Dan Johnson of PandaUnite.org, the People Against the NDAA. Dan, welcome to the Tim Danahy Show.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Well, Dan, first let's talk about an overview of the entire NDAA, the National Defense Authorization Act. What's its scope? Is it intended to be just a budget document, but have they buried a lot of stuff in it?
So the National Defense Authorization Act itself is a military budget bill. It's passed every year. This kind of the going from a temporary army to a standing army shortly after World War II. And since about the 1980s, the National Defense Authorization Act has become a catch-all for not just the military budget, but for all kinds of different things, whether it's for the militarization of the police, whether it's increasing the influence of the war on terror, or whether it's working in the Secretary of Defense providing material support to the Boy Scouts. There have been all kinds of things that aren't related to the military budget that have been stuck in the NDAA. It's kind of become a haystack that you throw as many needles into as possible, because if you're a senator or a representative and you vote against the NDAA, your opponent can then use it against you and say, well, you voted against the troops.
So they use that card that if you don't support the NDAA, then they say you're against the troops, and so senators have to, and House of Representative members have to fall into line just on that weak argument. But the truth is that there's some particularly, I mean, the defense budget in itself is an area open for discussion, but Panda Unite seems to be especially concerned about some hidden dangers within the NDAA. What would those hidden dangers be?
Sure. So in order to understand the parts of the NDAA, particularly the 2012 National Defense Authorization Act that we're concerned about, it's important to understand the short history of the domestic war on terror. So back in 2001, the United States Congress passed the 2001 authorization for use of military force in Afghanistan. And this 2001 AUMF essentially includes in it that the president has the authority to use all necessary and appropriate force against any suspected terrorist groups outside the United States that had no geographical boundaries except for outside the United States. And the courts interpreted, and the Bush administration pushed for this interpretation, that the 2001 AUMF meant that he could detain U.S. citizens or kill U.S. citizens outside the United States as well under this particular legislation. So it was America's official entry into the war on terror. And when you create an area as a battlefield, and you say the president has the authority to use all necessary and appropriate force on that battlefield, what they also did was the laws of war, the international laws of war, foreign Geneva Convention, international laws of war have two categories of people that everyone is supposed to fit in, combatants and non-combatants. So if you're in a war, you have to treat combatants a certain way, you have to treat non-combatants a certain way. And in captivity, it is prohibited on both non-combatants and combatants. The use of torture is prohibited. Shortly after 9/11, the Bush administration did not care for this much, so we reinterpreted the international laws of war applying to our own war on terror, and we created a new category called enemy belligerents. Now, a belligerent, or I should say unlawful enemy combatant. So you weren't considered in any of those two categories, and therefore you had none of the protection of the Geneva Conventions in an international laws of war situation. But you had all the punishments, and this is what we used to torture those people in Guantanamo Bay who were accused of plotting or directly being directly involved with 9/11. Now, so just follow me here. The 2001 AUMF applied a different section of the laws of war to people and allowed them to be tortured legally because we ignored, essentially, international laws of war. Once we did that, the Bush administration pushed for the 2001 AUMF to also apply to detaining non-U.S. citizens inside the United States, to change the geographical boundaries of the laws of war. The Supreme Court did not agree or disagree with that. They left it as an open question. And so the 2012 NDAA and stuff, this Military Commissions Act come along, and essentially the first Military Commissions Act says military jurisdiction is all over the country, and military tribunals can try any non-citizen inside the United States. And then the 2012 NDAA does two things. Number one, removes the requirement, the 2001 AUMF, that they have to be pointed to be directly tied to 9/11. And number two, it removes the geographical limitations on the 2001 authorization for use of military force, and says not only is the world a battlefield, but the United States is a battlefield. And the same change in law that we put forth so that we could torture suspected terrorists in the Guantanamo Bay Naval Facility, that exact same category, at the president's discretion, under sections 1021 and 1022 of the 2012 NDAA, can now apply to any person around the world, including an American citizen, and can apply to any person inside the United States, also including an American citizen. It brought the war on terror home.
Well, what strikes me in this, Dan, I mean, shouldn't we have constitutional protections against an arbitrary declaration of any president saying that we are combatants or non-combatants or, you know, enemies belligerent? I mean, I remember shortly after 9/11 that the, I believe it was the Quakers, you know, were cited as being a terrorist or under terrorist investigation because they promoted pacifism. Aren't there some sort of protections on this?
Well, there are technically some sort of protections. I mean, you have the Bill of Rights that's attached to the Constitution. You have longstanding precedent that we have to, you are required to get a jury trial, and you're required to be represented by an attorney. But under the War on Terror, much like in the 1933 Enabling Act and in the Decree for the Protection of People in the State of the Third Reich, or the Reichstag Fire Decree, also signed in 1933, they place those constitutional provisions aside because there's a faceless, nameless enemy that is so scary and so dreadful that only the government can defeat it, and you must give up your liberty and your freedom and hand it over to that government, or they'll never be able to defeat this huge enemy. And it's a facade for continuing to take more and more powers with this.
Well, Dan, one looks at this, and you know, I'm just going to ask a general question about the NDAA, and if these powers, these presidential powers, arbitrary powers, are to be continued or expanded, it would strike me as if that it would serve the executive power and the military. It would serve them well if we were constantly at war. Is that correct?
The courts, the legislature, have always deferred to the executive branch in times of war. So as long as we stay in perpetual war, they can continue to claim that, as Tom Cotton does, that we're living in the most dangerous time in history and that we need to have a war on our own population as well as a war around the world.
Well, you know, it reminds me of a statistic that CBS News came out with about a 15-month period from 1970 to 1971. There were over 3,000 bombings in the United States, and there was never an attempt to subjugate our freedoms or our rights as a response to these bombings. And so right now, what they're doing, while we are safe, they are saying that we are safe because we are using the NDAA's powers. Am I correct?
Well, they claim that they need the NDAA's powers, but not necessarily claim that the powers are being used currently. But the way that we figure that those powers are being used, a case was brought against the specific section 1021b2, the expansion of the, you have to be directly tied to 9/11 to, well, you just have to be somewhat vaguely supporting terrorism, or we accuse you of that. There's a lawsuit that was filed by the Freedom 7, including Tangerine Bowen, award-winning author Chris Hedges, etc., called Hedges v. Obama. And that case, in district court, the district judge, Catherine Forrest, struck down this as unconstitutional. And she issued an injunction on the use of the law. The government, in a very unusual move, filed an emergency stay so they continue using the power. And they had the injunction overturned within about a week. That tells me, if you're not using this power, why do you need an emergency stay? Why do you need emergency use of this power? Right now, it would irreparably harm national security, according to the government's own lawyers. It would irreparably harm national security if you lose this. That means they're probably using it. And the danger of the NDAA is that is the only proof you'll ever have. Is we will only have a probably. You're arrested without a charge, without a trial, and you're whisked off to a secret court if you get a court at all. That's the danger of the NDAA, is we will not, more than likely will not, unless you have a Snowden-like figure who exposes what the government has been doing in that area, we won't know what they're using it for, or if they're using it.
Well, it's a frightening situation, Dan. It really is. But, Dan, what we're going to have to do is break for a quick commercial, and then when we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about the National Defense Authorization Act, the NDAA, and I also want to talk about Panda Unite and to see what can happen with this. We're talking with Dan Johnson of People Against the National Defense Authorization Act, pandaunite.org, and you're listening to him here on the Tim Danny Show. We'll be right back.
That was the week. Fukushima radiation is reaching our shore.
Welcome to this episode of the Tim Danahy Show's American History Minutes. In 1995, when the U.S. Senate was considering the United States as part of the World Trade Organization, Ralph Nader challenged every member of Congress to read the entire treaty and answer 10 simple questions in public. Nader asked because he saw no evidence that any congressman even read what was in the bill that would represent the greatest surrender of local, state, and national sovereignty in United States history. Of all the members of Congress, only Senator Hank Brown of Colorado had the fortitude to accept Nader's challenge. He read the World Trade Agreement, sat down in front of an audience and cameras, and correctly answered 12 questions. His response to actually reading the treaty? He said he believed in free trade, but he was stunned how the World Trade Organization was a threat to national sovereignty. No other member of Congress showed evidence of reading the bill, and Senator Brown went to his fellow senators and tried to tell them the trade agreement was bad for America. However, no one changed their vote. The U.S. became part of the World Trade Organization, and all our legislation that affects business and consumers is subjugated to the final authority of the World Trade Organization. The world's greatest deliberative body didn't even read the bill that surrendered our ability to freely make future laws. This American History Minute is brought to you by The Tim Danahy Show. Please like us on Facebook at Tim Danahy Show, follow us on Twitter at hashtag Tim Danahy Show, and listen to us at Danahy.com.
Plutonium is leaking in Paducah, Kentucky, while you scratch a card to see if you're lucky. Wars in the Congo to make our cell phones. Mercury in your teeth, fluoride in your bones.
Why? Why do you send your food money to faraway factory farms and industrial ranchers distributing through megastores headquartered in other cities, other states? It doesn't make sense. You can keep your dollars local. Help your local farmer, your local rancher, your local retailer, your neighbors. And it comes back. Your commitment to the local food shift means more money stays in the community and is reinvested here. Reinvested in you. It's easy and it's smart. Go to localfoodshift.com. Learn how to buy local and watch it grow here. Localfoodshift.com.
Our food causes cancers, but that was the week. The stars and their dancers, Monsanto is changing the food that we eat.
Welcome back to the Tim Danahy Show here at Danahy.com, and we are talking with Dan Johnson, who is with the People Against the National Defense Authorization Act. You can find out more at Panda, like Panda Bear, PandaUnite.org, and you can find out more about, really, it transcends just the budget aspects of the Defense Department. That has a lot of black issues, a lot of questionable appropriations. That also goes through like the House Armed Services Committee with Mac Thornberry, who we mentioned on this show. We did a special about that guy and what he's trying to do with the budgeting process. But within the NDAA, there is abuses of executive power, potential abuses of executive power, which trample upon our constitutional rights, and it's just a frightening situation that's going on. Dan, to put this, these powers that the executive office wants, and really it's coming out from the FBI that, you know, through metadata searches, through phone calls, through torture, through all these other tools that the government, the executive office has taken to fight terrorism, there really is no evidence that anything, any worthwhile information has been obtained or any terrorist plot has been thwarted. Is that correct?
To the best of my knowledge, that is correct.
And so even though that the use, the temporary use of this power has been used, it has had absolutely no beneficial effect in the war on terror. And so we can only speculate as to why they would want to continue it and enhance it. Would you have any speculation in that regard?
Well, it's curious as to why we are fighting a war on terror when, for the probably a better effect, we should be fighting a war on falling furniture. And the reason I say that is a 2011 report from the Counterterrorism Center pointed out that anywhere in the world, not just in the United States, anywhere in the world, with the one exception of 9/11, which, as we know, is now 14 years behind us, with the one exception of 9/11, so this study was focused on 2011. In the year 2011, there were as many Americans killed by terrorism as killed by falling furniture. If a falling piano is just as dangerous as a terrorist, then the question of why we have spent billions and trillions of dollars on the war on terror is it has a simple answer. There is no other answer. Terror is extreme fear. And every dictator, every politician who claimed they were for the people while seizing great power themselves, from Egypt to Europe, from Latin America to China, always ruled using one word: fear. A war on terror, a war on fear, a war on an emotion is a signal that they are ruling you by fear. Your fear is what they're trying to protect you from. Therefore, as long as they can scare you, they can point you in any direction you want, take away any of your liberties that they want, and make no mistake, history has proven that this is nothing more than a grasp of power, and I would say this time around, the statistics have proven that it's nothing more than a grasp for power.
Well, it's amazing how they can how the government, in many cases, and also in the private sector, can manufacture fear in order to justify some extremely profitable endeavors. It has a long history of doing that, and typically, there was one time when we did not have a national enemy, and we did not fire a shot or commit a troop overseas, and that was during Jimmy Carter's administration, and everybody called it a national malaise. And, so fear is all prevalent in the way that government conducts its business and exacts what they want. But, Dan, I think you've pointed out clearly that, really, we do not need to be at fear. If we're going to fear anything, we should fear falling furniture, because more people have died of falling furniture, and I recognize that. Besides trying to get the message out to get people to not be afraid, what can people do to be proactive on this issue and these kinds of issues?
Well, the first thing you should do is you should take sections of the NDAA, and you should take resources on our website, pandunite.org, including letters from 50 former generals and admirals who are concerned about the provisions of the 2012 NDAA, and letters from retired judges, retired FBI agents. Take some of those letters and take the sections of the 2012 NDAA to your local sheriff. To your local police officers, if you know anyone in law enforcement locally. Because in order for the military to detain someone, the easiest way to do it is to send local law enforcement to do it and not tell local law enforcement why. Just say, there's no warrant, the national security issue, just pick them up. Or they can go in themselves. Either way, it's likely that local law enforcement will know about it, will learn about it. One of the best things you can do is educate them that this exists, and that there's a possibility that it may be utilized at one time in their community, and they should watch out for that. A great example of a police department that did watch out for it, there's a police department, I believe it's the Nashville or Knoxville, I can't remember which, Tennessee Police Department, I want to say it was Nashville, they got an order from the Secret Service to go question and detain someone and enter their house, and search it, and there was no warrant. And the police officers asked the Secret Service agent, "Where's your warrant?" Secret Service agent says, "Just wave a piece of paper in front of the door." Those officers refused to do so and effectively protected that person's rights. That's one thing. Another thing is we have the Restoring Constitutional Governance resolution, which has been passed by 7 jurisdictions, including the capital of New York, You can advocate for that to be passed in your community and educate your local community leaders about the dangers of something like this and who could be considered a terrorist under the 2012 NDA and then be locked up indefinitely without charge or trial. I also recommend looking up the documents yourself, going on the website or any website that actually has 2012 NDAA, and looking at the sections that say, such as Section 1021C1, detention under the law of war without trial until the end of hostilities authorized by the authorization for use of military force. That is a quote. That type of thing, those three actions, I think, are really important, and focus local, because you may not be able to affect what happens at the Joint Chiefs of Staff meeting and the Joint Chiefs of Staff command, but you can make sure that they have a heck of a time violating someone's rights in your community. The roadblocks stop at your local level. They don't stop the federal government. They don't stop the state government, even to a certain extent. At the local level is where the roadblocks need to be, and that's my recommendation.
And Dan, is there still a posse? Is it called Posse Comitatus in the United States that was enacted, I believe, shortly after the Civil War, where it is illegal to use federal troops on U.S. soil?
So Posse Comitatus, the Posse Comitatus Act, essentially said you cannot use the Army, specifically. You cannot use the Army on U.S. soil. Posse Comitatus is Latin for power of the county. So it was the county handles its own law enforcement affairs. The military does not lead. However, Posse Comitatus Act was amended shortly after the Oklahoma City bombing and has also been reinterpreted in the courts and particularly by the military. It really has no conceivable effect on military operations. As you can see, the military was brought in for the G20. They were brought in for the Republican National Convention, and I believe even the Democratic National Convention. The military has been brought in on numerous occasions. Boston bombing, for example. Posse Comitatus was a nice concept, but really has failed to protect people in the United States today.
So if we do not have the protections under Posse Comitatus, then really it does become imperative for people to get involved. I would presume that people could go online, take a look at NDAA, and as you said, take a look, for example, and maybe it should be the starting point, Section 1021C1, see what that's all about, and then perhaps work in both directions from there just to see what's in here. This is another equivalent to a TPP where they're trying to pass this in secret without much public debate and hoping that people will rally around it by saying that if you don't support it, you don't support our troops. Nothing could be further from the truth. And Dan, I'm hoping that you will keep us posted, stay on top of this issue, and hopefully we can be successful in creating some accountability here.
Yeah, I certainly hope so. Thank you so much for having me on the show. And this has happened in the United States once before, Japanese American internment, 1941. So the people of the United States have a chance to stop it, much like the fugitive slave acts were pushed back on the local level, preventing slaves from being returned to their owners. And that win will be at the local level. Educate yourself, educate your local law enforcement, and let's see if we can prevent this this country from being a closed society.
Excellent work, Dan. Dan Johnson with People Against the National Defense Authority Act, and you can find National Defense Authorization Act. You can find out more at pandaunite.org, and it's like panda bear, pandaunite.org. And Dan, thank you so much for being on the Tim Danahy Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's been an honor.
Altering seats with deceit. Roundup is coming out in your urine. My brothers in prison are torturing urine. Jill Stein and Sherry are shackled to chairs.
A good man, real people, clear thinking, enjoyable, quality talk, a new name, EgbertoWillies.com. He talks politics. He talks issues. And you can hear his radio shows and read his blog at EgbertoWillies.com. You can link to him here at Danahy.com. He's also part of CoffeePartyUSA.com's network. Or, if you can spell EgbertoWillies.com, you found a new voice you'll want to hear. EgbertoWillies.com.
Media's acting like they're unaware, while Obama and Romney from Wall Street debating, doing each other incestuous mating, but we didn't care.
You hear the music we're playing here on the Tim Danahy Show. We like to feature socially aware music by independent artists across the country. So if you have music or you know a musician who would like us to feature their songs, contact us through Danahy.com. Send us an MP3 version or a link, a little bit about you and permission to use it on the show. And we'll listen. We'll try to feature it and we'll post your link for everyone to see. Music is a part of the Tim Danahy Show community. We'd love for you to be that part here at Danahy.com.
No. We only saw what they chose to show. We got our kicks. We're not complaining. It's only news. If it's entertaining, oh, that was the week.
You preserve a nation one community at a time, with shared knowledge and an informed electorate, with many voices speaking with civility and integrity. And we will preserve our nation when we participate, we learn, we discuss, we vote. We are the Coffee Party USA. Join us today. CoffeePartyUSA.com.
That was the week. Shell kills the Ogoni. There's blood in its oil. Texaco's burning a forest to spoil. Bovine growth hormone is milking the public, but that was the week.
Welcome back to the Tim Danahy Show here at Danahy.com, and I want to thank Dan Johnson for being our guest. He's with PandaUnite.org, and they're doing some really wonderful work trying to stay ahead of the issues with the National Defense Authorization Act, and particularly the little things that are in there in this 1,000-page act, the little things that are trying to take away some of our rights. So, Dan Johnson, thank you. Good luck at PandaUnite.org, and I encourage you listeners to be involved with this, too. I have kind of an editorial here, a kind of a rant coming up, and I thought I would print it as kind of a blog on our website, but I decided not to. And the subject is how to make the presidential debates interesting. And it was subtitled, "Can You Say Final Four?" So let me just go through these thoughts and share them with you. Because every week, almost every week, it seems like a new person, some self-confident Republican or Democrat, comes forth and declares their candidacy for president. And they all do the same thing. They pronounce an upcoming major announcement. They schedule a press conference, and they announce the reason that they're running for president. And they're going to do the same thing that it seems like all the other candidates are promising, too. But it kind of surprises me that some of these people are just, you know, who are these people? And why do they think that they are particularly qualified, capable, or probable to become the next presidents? Because as of this writing, for example, there's about 16 Republican candidates. There's so many that debate organizers are wondering how to get them all on stage so they can provide really what will be essentially the same answers to the same questions without sounding and looking like some sort of Republican choir. I mean, it's a crazy situation. And truthfully, as far as debates go and as far as educating the public, it promises to be a pretty mindless exercise because they're not going to have the opportunity for any kind of substantive discussion about issues and what their priorities are. And so that's why here on this show, on the Tim Danahy Show, I'm proposing that really the only viable way to conduct this media circus is a playoff system, a presidential debate playoff system, complete with brackets and odds. We have a final four, and then we ultimately have a debate champion. So think about it. You know, we could do a show like the NFL does a NFL draft, or like the NCAA Final Four. They have these a day where they announce all the brackets and who will play who. We could do a show with like a lottery with debate pairings could be determined. And you could say, oh my God, you know, Chris Christie just do Scott Walker, and two failed governors are going to debate. You know, we got to see this on TV. Or we could take a look and think of, oh my goodness, candidate Santorum and candidate Huckabee, the two of them are going to debate. Let's see which one of them can justify war and capitalism using biblical quotes. You know, it's nuts, but it would be great TV. And then it could also go from the sublime to the ridiculous. You know, there's two candidates out there. Most of you may or may not know, excuse me, Carly Fiorina and is it George Pataki, Walt Pataki, whatever, a former guy from New York. But really, who would watch that debate? You know, they would watch Bill O'Reilly or something instead. But think about this. We would have all of these one-on-one debates that would capture the nation's attention. And after each debate, the two candidates can, you know, stand on either side of Carson Daly, and they can look at the camera and kind of do that awkward smile and with kind of like a nervous look that says, please vote for me. It would be like TV's The Voice. You know, a toll-free number can appear under each candidate, and people can text their vote for who won. And then the votes can be tallied and the winner announced, and they would have that tension that leads up to the announcement. And just watching while some candidates advance while others fall by the wayside, that would just be priceless. And you just think about how the media could play this up. You know, the media experts could do pre-debate analyses from like a semicircle desk on a soundstage, just like NFL football does it. And so we could have people like Pat Buchanan and George Will, you know, to add for, you know, the seriousness, the gravitas. And then we can have a character like Ted Nugent in there for kind of comic relief. And then, you know, we can have special people come in there and just to kind of make it entertaining. But here is where I would propose something that would really jazz up the debates and make a growing media sensation. Does anybody besides me remember Mystery Science Theater 3000? Yeah, I'm thinking we need those silhouetted backs of the heads of three people. And I'm thinking like Chuck Todd or Sean Hannity or Steve Doocy. And they can give running commentary about what the candidates say. And, I mean, this would have real potential as a great television theater. I mean, and it would be free. And I'm sure that we could get sponsors for this and, you know, and they would support this because, you know, these sponsors would love to see their candidates on TV, and, you know, it wouldn't cost that much to produce either. You know, all they need is a few more dollars for some minimum wage non-union camera operators, maybe a temporary producer who wants to retire but can't, and maybe a part-time sound engineer with a young family, but he doesn't have any benefits. I mean, it wouldn't take much to put this on, and the debates could be handicapped, and you could have odds. You know, it would be fabulous. And just think of the ratings. I mean, tension would build as the debates winnow out the weaker candidates, and it all leads to a Final Four weekend in a host city, maybe like Madison, Wisconsin or something. You know, they need the activity. You know, there would be parties held, there would be celebrity A-listers and intelligentsia there. I mean, it would be just a fabulous way to attract attention to the candidates around the country. And ultimately, they would have to give real answers to real questions. But can you imagine like a final debate, you know, say between Hillary Clinton and Jeb Bush or something, you know, I mean, what could they say one-on-one that wouldn't occur in a group of 16 all making various platitudes and standard statements. But people would text in their answers. You know, a winner would be declared, confetti would fall from the ceiling, music would play, families would gather around and embrace, and it would just be total game show theater. And if you don't think that this has enough gravitas for a presidential election, don't worry, because I think it would get even better if the Bush family and the Clinton family square off for maybe a special appearance on Family Feud, presidential edition. You'll be able to watch Hillary and Jeb have their hands poised over the red buttons whenever the game show host Steve Harvey instructs, name a political party who has lost touch with the American people, and both the Clintons and the Bushes are clueless. And sad to say, you know, as a commentary and tongue-in-cheek, that's the way that big money and big media would be electing a president. All right, I want to thank all of you for putting up with that little rant, and I want to thank you for joining us on the show, and we will be back tomorrow here on the Tim Danahy Show.
That was the week of corporate crime. Whitewash of justice, time after time. Oh, that was the week voting rights.
The Tim Danahy Show would like to thank Aaron Taylor of SRC Labs for production management and outreach strategies, and Presonus, a leading designer and manufacturer of audio recording software, hardware, and related accessories available at Guitar Center. For Edward Danahy for post-production assistance, and for all the stations and affiliates who carry the Tim Danahy Show. And lastly, to Theodore, the studio bull terrier, for his quiet companionship.
That was the year civil liberties ended. Oh, that was the week, that was the year, those were the stories we didn't hear. That was the week, that was the week, that was the week.